One Africa, one Africa, one nation.
Greetings, greetings, and welcome to Caribbean Forum here on the Uhuru Radio Network, where we expand our ability to communicate and unite the struggles of African people towards victory and independence in our lifetime. I'm Ron Bob Semple, and here on the Forum, we examine issues that affect Caribbean and Caribbean American nationals, both at home and across the diaspora. We bring you news, views, interviews, thought-provoking discussions, Caribbean theater of the mind, and of course, musical interludes. Well, we do apologize for this late start of Caribbean Forum this morning. We are experiencing some technical difficulties, and we're here now live, and we hope you'll stay with us until 11 a.m. Well, this week we conclude saluting and recognizing our women during Women's History Month. Well, today we'll once again look at domestic violence, not just in Guyana, but in the Caribbean region. We'll share with you a documentary, Break the Silence, Stop the Violence, that is narrated by journalist and actress Margaret Lawrence. The film was produced by the help of Help and Shelter organization in Guyana, and representing the organization will be activist Danuta Radzik, who will be joining us in about 20 minutes or so. Okay, we'll just take a brief interlude of music here and then try to reorganize ourselves. Okay, so stay tuned, please. Here are the Yoruba Singers featuring Ezzy Rockliffe with Bleeding with Hate.
Can go to London as a black man, they'll reject you. If you go to Sweden, my brother, they won't accept you. If you go to Russia, we've got one struggle to fight. Right here in Guyana, we've been ruled for a long, long time. All through the days of slavery, oh, they really messed up our minds. Sometimes from the gods of forefathers, the strength we gain to free ourselves, to free ourselves, oh, from those chains. Oh, the slave ships in its hatch holes. By the thousands, my people died in the cane fields, on the plantations. Let them hear the little children cry.
Caribbean Forum. I'm Ron Bob Semple with you. Back with Third World's Reggae Ambassador. Well, my next guest is a global ambassador. In addition to being a professor of literary and cultural studies at the University of the West Indies, Mona Campus in Jamaica. And joining us from the land of wood and water is Carolyn Cooper. Good morning and welcome
morning,
once again to the broadcast.
Ron. I love that title you have given me, a global ambassador. Yeah. I hope your words are prophetic.
Well, I certainly hope they are also, Carolyn.
Nice to be back on the program, Ron. You're doing a great job.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
I hope the telethon is a fantastic success and you'll get all the money you need.
Absolutely. Carolyn, your latest project is Global Reggae, a plenary of lectures from a conference convened at the University of the West Indies. How has this concept developed?
Well, I tell you, in 1992, I had the idea to set up a reggae studies center in Jamaica because I felt that we really needed to reflect on the music and its global impact. And surprisingly enough, you know, it didn't take very long for the university administration to agree, and we got the program set up. Of course, it was on the basis that we wouldn't be asking them for any money. So what we did, we focused on having people, artists, coming in and talking about their work. You know, it was just a fantastic series of activities. And I initiated the Bob Marley lecture where, you know, every year we'd have a distinguished lecture. So it is coming out of that whole process of the university taking reggae seriously. And in fact, for Bob Marley's 50th birthday, the university, our center, collaborated with the Bob Marley Foundation, and we put on an excellent conference. And a book came out that was co-edited with Eleanor Wint and myself, called Bob Marley, The Man and His Music. So we had a lot of seminars and things. But I wanted to have a conference that focused on the global impact of reggae, just for us to take a stock of where reggae has gone. Because sometimes in Jamaica, we really don't understand that complex process by which, you know, reggae music has just gone to every single country of the globe. Mm. And that song you started with, Reggae Ambassador, by, you know, by Third World, they ask a very important question. It's everywhere we jam, it's the same question. How such a big music come from a little island, you know? Mm. And that is the question that we're trying to answer at the conference. And so I assembled scholars who have been studying reggae in various contexts. And we started with Erna Broadbent, Jamaican sociologist. She's a historical sociologist and a novelist, short story writer. And she did the first essay in the book, which was the opening plenary lecture on reggae as black space. And she started, we started with Jamaica as a center and looked at what impact reggae had in Jamaica. And she clearly saw that this is where Rastafari consciousness, black power, all of these forces to affirm the identity of black people, African people in the diaspora, all of this came through reggae. And by the way, today, you know, we're heading to Mabé for the celebration, or to mark, it's not so much celebration, commemorating the 50th anniversary of the Coral Gardens massacre, where Rastafari were massacred in Jamaica. And I can say in half a century, we have come a long way in terms of a society in recognizing the value of Rastafari, but it wasn't so in the early days of the Liberty. So anyhow, we start with Erna Broadbent, looking at the ideas in reggae. And then we went to a very important musician in Jamaica, Peter Ashburn, classical as well as, you know, popular and folk performance. He teaches at the Edna Mandy College of the Visual and Performing Arts. And Peter looked at the music as music, looking at two moments of transition in the music from mento to ska and reggae to dancehall. So the third chapter now looks at reggae in the UK, where we're looking at how the movement first follows migrant Jamaicans to Britain. And Amon Saba Sakana, he is Trinidadian. He used to be Sebastian Clark, but he decided that that was not the right name for him. Changed his name to Amon Saba Sakana. And he has a very important publishing house, Karnak House, based in the UK. He now spends his time between Trinidad and the UK. So he looked at the impact of Jamaican music in Britain.
Mm.
And recognizing the role of the producers, you know, the people who set up the infrastructure to get the music out. But it's interesting, you know, that I don't think our artists have still benefited enough from their intellectual property in the music. And it has to do, I think, with the way in which we weren't so conscious of the business of music, you know? And these are some of the issues that Saba picks up in his chapter.
Right. A moment ago, Carolyn, you mentioned Bob Marley.
Yes.
And we lost Bob Marley almost 22 years ago.
Yes.
Were he still alive today, do you feel that reggae music could have gone to even higher heights globally?
Well, I don't know how much more high we could want to go, you know, because we are everywhere. But the question is, you know, what would Marley be doing now? I guess the same kind of thing that Burning Spear is doing, you know, the other foundation artists that have survived. They're still doing the music, conscious music,
right,
as we call it in Jamaica,
yes,
you know, carrying the message. And, you know, when you look at where reggae has gone, I went to Papua New Guinea in the 1990s. I was on a fellowship at the University of the South Pacific. And I said, I don't know when I'm ever going to come back to this part of the world. And Papua New Guinea fascinated me because it seemed to me to be Africa in the Pacific. And I got a chance to go there.
Hmm.
Yeah, soon I reached there, Papua New Guinea reggae. And it's not just copying our reggae. They had created reggae that spoke to their own cultural situation. And I think this is one of the complex ideas that keep coming up in all of the essays in the book, that, you know, Marvin Sterling, Jamaican, who has done work on reggae dancehall in Japan, his book has just been published by Duke University Press, and it has a lovely name. It's called Babylon East, performing dancehall, roots, reggae, and Rastafari in Japan. And he looks at the way in which Japanese youth have gravitated towards Jamaican popular culture as a way of expressing their alienation from Japanese culture.
What is it about reggae music that has caused its longevity?
Well, I think that the burning theme in reggae, chanting down systems of oppression, you know, the critique of inhumane systems and the call for social justice, that has been the foundation message of reggae. And when you look at social movements across the globe in the 20th century, now into the 21st century, you see that this is a fundamental issue that people across the globe can, you know, respond to, because everywhere you end up with systems where politicians are exploiting the masses of the people. And, you know, music becomes a way through which you can express your sense of power, and you can challenge without necessarily going in the streets and taking up arms, but that music becomes a psychological power. It gives you the strength to keep going.
Different Caribbean nations have their individual musical identification. So
yes.
Jamaica, you know, the reggae, Trinidad and Tobago, say calypso and soca,
yes.
Haiti, Guadeloupe and Martinique, zouk. Why does Barbados seem to have a music of resistance?
Why does Barbados?
Yes.
I don't understand the question. Why do they have or they don't have?
Oh, they don't have the music of resistance.
No, they do, man. They do. Yes, yes, yes.
Yes.
You see, Barbados has an unfortunate image of being Little England and being a compliant, submissive society. But it is not.
Yes.
There are spaces of resistance, but sometimes we don't see it as resistance. You know, George Lamming wrote a brilliant novel, In the Castle of My Skin.
Yes.
His first novel. And there was a moment in the novel where the villagers took up stones to, you know, to hit Crichton. I think he was the landlord. I can't remember, I haven't read the novel recently, but he was a symbol of the plantocracy. And nobody could throw the stone because there was such a sense of respect for authority. But that moment of not throwing the stone and not taking a physical action that would have dire consequences does not undermine the level of rebellion and resistance and revolution among the people. It's just that they didn't throw the stone. But the anger and the sense of injustice was there. And you see this in their music. One of my colleagues, Kerwin Best, who has done a lot of work on Barbadian popular music, you know, if you read his work, you will see that there is in Barbados a music of resistance, but it may not manifest itself in exactly the same way as
right.
it does
okay.
in other Caribbean societies.
Right. Absolutely, absolutely.
Amen.
If you've just joined us for this abbreviated broadcast of Caribbean Forum this morning, I'm Ron Bob Semple with you here on the Uhuru Radio Network. We're chatting with Carolyn Cooper, the author of Global Reggae. Well, she's edited.
Let me just clarify.
Editor.
Yes. I do have an article in it where I look at the whole development of reggae studies at the University of the West Indies, and I do an introduction that gives you an overview of what the book is about. But, you know,
right.
it's really a collaborative project. And I really want to big up all of the people who took part. You probably know Roger Stephens. He's a white American who played a major role in getting reggae spread to North America. He was based in California. He had a reggae radio show, and then he did a magazine. And he was instrumental in bringing people to reggae. Sunsplash, you know.
Okay, right.
I want to just mention a couple of other people. Louis Chudi Soke, born in Jamaica, Nigerian father, Jamaican mother, and he's a brilliant literary scholar doing a lot of work on music. And his essay looks at what he calls roots, diaspora, and possible Africans. And he looks at the way in which sometimes Africans see themselves reflected in the music coming from the African diaspora. And sometimes we in the African diaspora don't recognize how important Africa is to the formation of our own musical traditions. And he looks particularly at Lucky Dube and the power of Lucky Dube's work and so on. Brent Clough, from New Zealand, based in Australia, did a brilliant chapter on oceanic reggae, where he's looking at the spread of reggae throughout the whole of Oceania, Australia, New Zealand, and all of those islands up and down the Pacific. So it's really a brilliant book. And Michael Veal, he's an African-American ethnomusicologist at Yale.
Okay.
He did a chapter on dub, electronic music, and sound experimentation. And we have people talking about French Caribbean, reggae in the French Caribbean, Teddy Isimamura, reggae in Cuba and the Hispanic Caribbean, Samuel Fury Davis, Leonardo Vidigal from Brazil, looking at reggae music documentaries, and most important, Ellen Curlings and Pete Lilly. They do a reggae dancehall magazine, 45,000 copies every 2 months, and they did an excellent chapter on reggae and dancehall in Europe, and their explanation for reggae in Germany is very fascinating, because they say popular music, the folk music of Germany, had been appropriated by the Nazis, and people rejected it, and so it couldn't be the basis of their new popular music. So people started to listen to America and Britain, and that is how they discovered Bob Marley and reggae. And the last person, two more people, Cheikh Amma Dieng from Senegal, a lecturer at the Cheikh Anta Diop University, looking at the reggae griots in Francophone Africa. And finally, a young, talented entertainment industries expert, Kamau Amen. He set up our degree program in entertainment and cultural enterprise management at the University of the West Indies. He's now in New York doing work on branding. And he gave an excellent account of why it is we felt at the University of the West Indies that we needed to move into this era of entertainment and cultural enterprise management. I'm telling you, it's the second most popular degree program in the Faculty of Humanities and Education. It's only mass communications that attracts more students. And, you know, if we had more places, a lot more students would take the program, because they recognize that the music industry has the potential to be a major income earner for us in the Caribbean. And I'm telling you, for Bob Marley's 70th birthday, we're planning a major conference and sending it out to the world so everybody who hears this can get ready. We're going to do a conference that I'm tentatively calling now After Bob Marley, the Creative Industries and Economic Development in the Caribbean and Beyond. How can we use the experience of Bob Marley to show us where the creative industries can take us in the Caribbean?
Well, we're certainly looking forward to that. You're speaking with Carolyn Cooper. Carolyn, just quickly, how could one get a copy of Global Reggae?
Amazon. Although every now and then when you go on Amazon, they say copies not available. That means they must be selling like hot bread, eh?
Amazon.com.
Just go to Amazon and you can order your copy.
Absolutely. And I hope you do tune into our radiothon next weekend, and you'll have an opportunity to get a copy of Global Reggae
compliments of the University of the West Indies Press.
Absolutely. Carolyn, thank you very much as usual, and have yourself a happy market shopping, huh?
Yes. No, I've been back from the market. I tell you, I went very early to make sure I'm back on time for your program, eh?
Take care, Carolyn.
Okay, Have a great weekend.
Our next hour we'll be dedicating to domestic violence, not only in Guyana, but
this is Max Ramo with Take Back
region.
The Land and the Emojo
we'll
Village. You are listening to UhuruRadio.com, the online voice of the International African Revolution.
On April 6th and 7th, Burning Spear Media will hold our annual fundraising radiothon. We are the
Burning Spear Newspaper, Uhuru News, Uhuru Radio,
bringing you news, music, analysis, and information every week. We are your media.
You're telling the truth about your world.
The truth you won't get from your local newspaper.
We need your support to survive and grow.
Tune in April 6th and 7th for our two-day radiothon, a live online radio and video broadcast
with 20 hours of special guests.
Liberate your media with your dollars.
Africa is on the rise and the future is black.
Come home to Guyana, the land of many waters.
House lots for sale in beautiful Guyana own a piece of paradise. A modern community, Elaineville is a paradise in the making.
Come home to golden sunshine, Guyana, come home to paradise.
Located at
Providence, Guyana.
Elainville is an upscale community with 1/8, quarter, half, and 1 acre house lots for sale. Elainville, a gated community with concrete roads, concrete drains, pure water supply, electricity, and recreational park, just to name a few of its infrastructures. With immediate finance available from Hand in Hand and Citizens Bank, you can build your dream home in beautiful Guyana.
Make it Guyana again. Make it your own.
30 minutes from the airport, Elainville is a paradise in the making. For more info, visit our website, www.elainville.com.
Guyana, come home to paradise.
Hey, there must be a better way. Gotta be. Got to be a better way. Gotta be. Got to be. Got to be. A better way. Yeah. His favorite words is, I'm sorry. Baby, I'll never do it again. But over and over and over, it's the same thing again. You put makeup on, yeah, to cover your scars. I can see in your eyes, you're dying slowly. Get someone to treat you like a good woman, who will hold you on a pedestal, who praises you for all the good you do. Don't allow him to have you so bad the kids can't forget you. Find strength in God, cause I know he loves you. Now it's time to move on. You've been in this far too long. All the pain and the scorn have left you tired and worn. You walk more than he says. Why don't you see it? His life is no life. Don't you leave it, hey. Get someone to treat you like a good woman, who will hold you on a pedestal, who praises you for all the good you do.
Welcome back to Caribbean Forum. I'm Ron Bob Temple with you here on the Hulu Radio Network. We're here every Saturday from 9 until 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Well, men who lose their position as the traditional breadwinners in the family often face what is called a crisis of masculinity. Unable to provide for their families due to rising unemployment, they unfortunately often resort to violence to reestablish their dominance and control upon their families. Well, such theories have contributed significantly to the general understanding of domestic violence in industrialized countries. But it seems as if in the Caribbean, there has been an uptake. Well, joining me from Guyana is Danuta Radzik, who is an activist and a researcher of domestic violence. Ms. Radzik, good morning and welcome to Caribbean Forum.
Good morning, everyone. I'm glad to be here.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure having you here. And as we conclude celebrating and you know, bigging up, as they say in the vernacular, our women during this Women's History Month. I wanted to dedicate this last hour, well, it's abbreviated broadcast this morning, this last hour of Caribbean Forum to domestic violence. Now, Ms. Radzik, you are a part of the Help and Shelter group there in Guyana. What are some of the challenges that you face?
Okay, well, our organization, which was started in 1995, we focus primarily on helping persons in crisis. And these would be persons who are experiencing some form of domestic abuse, gender-based violence, and or sexual abuse or other forms of abuse. So we work with women, we work with children, and we work with men. The work is very challenging because, as you know, domestic violence occurs not only in the Caribbean, but throughout the world.
Absolutely.
Yes, and in Guyana, our levels of domestic of domestic violence are very high. And in recent years, I think, fairly recently, the violence has escalated into actual killings. I mean, we always had large numbers of women who were being physically assaulted, sexually assaulted, psychologically abused, etc. But this escalated into the actual killing of women by their partners or husbands.
Ms. Radzik, what do you think? What do you think is attributable to this spike?
That's kind of hard to identify, but I think it has to do, one, with that maybe the services and the penalties for this kind of violence, it was not widespread enough, or for the penalties, they were not being enforced. And the other thing that is happening is that I do think, as you mentioned in your opening, that the situation in terms of the Caribbean and in Guyana is getting more difficult. Economically, things are, much more challenging. And so there's a lot more stress, I think, in the lives of people. And very often, when they are unable to deal with the stress, various forms of abuse tend to happen. But, it really has a lot to do. I think the root cause of it is the socialization that happens in the world, included in the Caribbean.
So in other words, you're saying...
socialize our children.
You're saying there is a link between domestic violence and societal violence.
Yes, and how we socialize our children. Because, if you socialize your girls to be passive, and to accept, various forms of abuse, then when they become adults and have children and families, they would be more tolerant of things like domestic violence. And if you raise your boy children to be dominant, to be always in charge, to be respected, to be, what their view is the one that should be followed, then when they become adults and have families and are husbands, what they do is that they perpetuate this kind of, these kind of values within their own family. And so the cycle tends to continue and to continue. So in the Caribbean, we all have a responsibility to raise our children equally, so that they are equal, right? They have equal rights, and that's the basis on which they should form relationships, that you might have differences, but no one deserves the right to be hit or abused by another person.
What I hear you saying, Ms. Radzik, is that there's need to reintroduce kindness and gentleness into everyday vocabulary as values that are important for every child and human being.
Yes, and the other thing is that, certainly I can speak for Guyana, there's a lot of stress, as I said, in terms of family relationships, and we have families where there are so many problems within the family unit, the fathers and mothers, that the children are often neglected and abused. And when children are abused, right, when children are abused, that abuse tends to remain with them as they progress through life. And we know, especially for our boy children, the way we parent in the Caribbean is that, the men are supposed to be manly. They're never supposed to cry, show emotion and so on.
Yeah, the rougher they are, the more macho they think they are.
Exactly. And then when they are in relationships and the women say, but you can't relate to me, there's no softness, that kind of thing. It has a lot to do with the way we socialize our boy children. So we have to do a better job at this, certainly. And I think that that's one of the key things towards reducing the kind of high levels of domestic violence that take place in the Caribbean. We have to start at the level of the family, and we have to start with our children. And it really needs a rethinking of it. Because the other thing is that the boys are, when they grow up, they are allowed to go out of the home more often than the girls, generally, right? They're more protective of our girls. I know that these roles tend to change, gender roles tend to change, but the thing is, if the boy is always allowed to go out of the house, the boy is supposed to do everything outside in the yard or in the community and so on. When he grows up, that's what he's used to. He's used to being able to go out much more than the woman. So for some men, it's really difficult to stay in a home and just socialize with their wives or girlfriends or whatever, because, you know, that was not the pattern that they grew up with. So there are all of these little things that we really need to look at.
You have a 16-year-old son, Ms. Radzik. How do you handle speaking to him about domestic violence?
Well, I've been speaking to him, of course, from since he was young. For example, I did not hit my son. I didn't beat him. And I must say that going through school and so on, he's never really had any behavioral problems at school, etc. Mm-hmm. And this is in the absence of corporal punishment, which is another thing that I know many people in the Caribbean firmly believe is the way to discipline children. But I'm certainly, and my son is an example of a child who was not hit. And behavior is good. It's, you know, he's fairly responsible.
We often hear... Yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Yes, we often hear of husbands violating their spouses, men, their girlfriends. In your research, Ms. Radzik, what percentage of domestic violence cases have you found that involves women physically or emotionally abusing men?
Okay, well, certainly, I mean, in all the research that we have done in our organization, and we do a lot, we do extensive work in communities and with church, faith-based organizations, churches, schools, etc. So we meet a lot of people. And men have said, and you know, consistently that they are abused, and that their abuse tends to be more of the emotional, psychological type, which is like you know, name calling, you know, damaging self-esteem, you know, criticizing, ridiculing, that kind of thing. Whereas with women, besides, they're also psychologically abused, but there are much higher levels of physical abuse and sexual abuse that they experience. So we certainly, and I mean, we run a counseling service at our organization, and men do come in as survivors of domestic violence. And, you know, we work with them, and we give them the same services that we would give any woman, because for us, it doesn't matter if you're male or female. If you're being hurt and if you're being abused, it hurts exactly the same. You know, there's nothing in men that says that they will feel less hurt at things. I mean, they might put up that front. But it is how we are made. We are humans. We're all humans.
Why do victims sometimes return to or stay with abusers?
Okay, well, one of the reasons for that is that domestic violence is a very, very complicated it's a very complicated issue. If it was easier, I think the whole world would have been able to overcome it. But so for persons who remain or go back to abusive situations, there are a number of reasons. One, that sometimes they are economically dependent on their abusive partner.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't have the economic means of moving on. Sometimes they are uneducated, have no skills. Therefore, it's not easy for them to go and get jobs, etc., and earn. Many of them, are usually in abusive situations for a number of years, so they're children. It's difficult to move with, say, 2-3 children.
Right, right, absolutely.
Right, economically. Yeah. Other reasons are like belief and values also keep people in abusive relationships. So, you know, some people are very, religious. And if the Bible, as state Christians, the Bible says, well, you know, when you're joined together, let no man put you asunder and so on, so that they will stay, some of them, because of their faith and their belief. Culturally, for some, in some cultures in cultural patterns, you cannot really actually go back. If you leave your family's house, your parents' house, you're not welcome back. Culturally, this cannot go back.
Yeah.
So they don't have that possibility of returning to their parents' home. Some of the other reasons is that the thing with domestic violence is it's a cycle. So they usually have tension builds, and then there's the abuse happens, and then many abusers after the violence or whatever happens, the type of abuse, are apologetic.
I'm glad you brought this up because in a moment we're going to hear from a domestic violence survivor. She's from Belize, and it's very, very interesting that you brought that up. But before we get to that that piece, Ms. Radzik, what are some immediate steps that must be taken to stem this tide of domestic violence in the Caribbean?
Well, I think first of all is that it's a problem for everybody in society.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, the government has a role to play. They have to ensure that the laws are in place and they're being implemented. They have to ensure that services are there to be given and available for persons who are being abused. Things like counseling should be offered to both the abused person and the abuser.
Is that being done in any form or fashion by the government there in Guyana right now?
We have laws. We have a domestic violence law since 1996.
I meant this financial support for NGO organizations such as the one you're involved with.
Well, we fundraise. We have to raise funds for three of our programmatic areas. The fourth one, which we have a shelter for battered women, the government does subsidize and give us money to run that shelter.
Okay.
It is one, I think another one is being built, but there's only one or two in the entire Guyana. And, you know, some of our regions are in the hinterland, in forested areas, you know. And so one certainly is not enough, so that they tend to be not enough shelters or temporary housing for persons who need to leave abusive situations. That is certainly a big, big challenge. And I think the other thing is that we need to socialize, you know, our society different. So we have to start in the schools. We have to start at the health centers. You know, faith-based organizations really need to take this, I think, a lot more on board. And to ensure that their members, you know, when they enter, when they decide to get married, that they actually counsel, they get real good, you know, marriage counseling, which focuses that, you know, this marriage should be one that is free of abuse. It must, you know, equality must be the basis under which the whole family unit and the marriage resolves, you know, around. So I think it's a challenge for all of us in society, for individuals, because we are raising, or we are not raising properly, but we are raising generations, the next generation. And if we can show example to our children,
yes,
this is the way to solve differences, you know, and ensure that we raise them equally, you know.
Absolutely.
That, you know, I think so. So really, it's a challenge for everyone, but the state also has a role to play. And sometimes, you know, we feel that not enough funds or money is allocated to these areas. But
okay.
It is so important, because relationships are the basis of life and everything that we do in life.
Absolutely true. We've been chatting with Dunuda Radzik of the Health and Shelter organization there in Guyana on domestic violence. And we're going to hear from a domestic violence survivor. Ms. Radzik, thank you. Thank you very much. And if you'd like to stay on the line and just listen to this survivor's. Okay, and we'll just chat for a moment before we get into that documentary. You know, Break the Silence, Stop the Violence, that was narrated by Margaret Lawrence, and it was produced by The Help and Shelter.
I call myself a survivor because I'm not a victim no more. I refuse to be a victim because when you're a victim, you're still in under control of that person, and I refuse to be controlled by anyone. So domestic violence for me started, I would say, when I started having relationships, you know, because I'm a survivor of childhood abuse also.
Yes.
So when you in abuse, you think it's okay.
Okay.
Back then, you don't get help. We don't know about getting help.
Right.
We don't even know about having somebody listen to us.
Right.
When you're a child. You know, so you grow up, and it's okay. Okay, I'm a mother.
Okay.
I'm a mother of three grown kids, five grandkids. And the domestic violence starts way back in Belize with my kid's father. And then coming to the state, it started my now husband. You know, coming here in America, it's like a different world. Because then the culture shock is so, so bad. When I got here, and I was going through the abuse. It was my ex abusing me. His certain part of his family was verbally and emotionally abusing me, which we have to remember that abuse is not only physical. People keep focus on just the physical part, but the worst part of abuse is the emotional and verbal part. Because when you get hit, you're going to forget that. But when that emotional abuse hits you, you could never forget that. You could either live by it, which means you're going to be under their control, or you can survive it and get to the point where you can talk about it and laugh about it. And that's where I'm at right now. I think the worst abuse that I've been through is when I'm married. Cheating is the worst abuse a woman could ever go through. First thing, you're emotionally abused. You're verbally abused. And sometimes you're physically and sexually abused. They take you layer by layer of your self-worth, your identity, and everything that goes along with it.
Wow.
So I look at cheating as the worst abuse you could ever go through. Because to me, when a person cheats, man or woman, I think that a man is more powerful than a woman in that form. I think a man should be a man. You don't want that person, just walk away.
Okay.
Because we women are very weak. You know, we are weak people.
Yes, we are the weaker.
We are the weaker.
Yes.
So I think that when cheating starts, a lot of people fight. That's domestic violence.
Right.
If somebody wants to go out and then the other person is trying to have that for, why don't you stay? Why don't, that's the cussing start.
Okay.
The pushing, the shoving start. When you're a child and you're being abused, emotional, verbal, wherever it is, you do not get the help that you need. You know, if you do not get the help that you need, then you grow up thinking, oh, it's okay. Especially when you're a child and you're going through certain abuse in your life and you try to bring it to somebody that are grown, they look at you and they say, oh, she's lying. Okay, so you grow up feeling like everything you're going to say from that point on is going to be lies. That's the only thing people are going to see from you. Even in my adult life, people would say, when my ex would say, oh, you're lying, you're just trying to get attention. Well, you know what? If I could get attention for the cause that I'm so passionate about, fine. You know, that's fine because I'm not going to be that little child no more. I'm way above that. What we have to realize is that when you go through abuse and people who abuse you, they want to make you look like the one that are the bad one.
Right.
You know, people tend to feel like, oh, if I try to bring her down. Because abuse is about control.
Yes.
If people cannot control you, they cannot abuse you.
Yes.
Oh, they have all kinds of signs. But you have the kind, like with my situation, the kind was, he was working and I was not working, so he was a provider. So I have to wait until he helps me out, mainly financially, you know, in order for me to have. So if he is not going to give me that part in my life, then I have to be beneath him. You have emotional control, you have verbal control, you get physical control and economic control.
Wow.
Those
wow.
are the main
wow.
factor in domestic violence.
Wow.
But then put all of them together, it's control.
Control.
No matter how you take it, it's a form of control.
You're right.
When you're abused, you don't have no self-love. Your moral is gone.
Okay.
Your self-love, you don't have that. And giving out, you don't have no self-esteem, so you're going to get what you put out there. The hardest thing for me to do is find someone who's going to listen. Because you have family members, you have in-laws that look at you like you're nothing because then you're putting up with it. Well,
right.
It's not a matter of you putting up with it. Like I said, you don't have no self-love. It took me a long time to finally get to this point where I'm at right now where I love me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm so in love with me.
You...
Well, first thing I would say, if you have somebody in domestic violence and you call that person friend, never put that person down. When you're putting a person down in domestic violence, you're doing just the same thing that person is going through in her home. Okay, so most of the time when people put other people down, they are going through the same thing. They are in abuse but refuse to acknowledge it and refuse to really say, well, this is what I'm going through. But they look at you when you start talking about it because they would love to talk about it. But just to shame, think about what others think about them. I don't care who think about me. I know who I am. And I refuse to make anybody put a label on me. When I was going through it, oh yeah, people put me down. I go home and I cry. But now when I talk about it and anybody want to, you know, talk to me about, I'm going to talk to them about it because this is mine. I have owned that.
Right.
I went through 5 years of therapy. Five years of therapy in order to get where I'm at in my life.
Right.
And I refuse at this point in my life to allow anybody to come into my life now and try to bring me down.
Right.
Oh, no, that's not going to happen.
Wow.
I would sit and talk with women, educated women,
right.
because we all have one thing in common. You could be the biggest person on this earth, and we all have that one thing in common, and we're dumb in love.
We're all.
I don't care who you are.
That's right.
You could be the president of the United States. We're all dumb in love. You know why? Because when you love hard.
No,
when you fall, you fall hard.
Yes.
Exactly.
It takes
yes.
over everything.
So people with education don't have to look down on somebody who don't have education because believe me, we're one at the end of the day.
On April 6th and 7th, Burning Spear Media will hold our annual fundraising radiothon. We are the
Burning Spear Newspaper, Uhuru News, Uhuru Radio.
Bringing you news, music, analysis, and information every week. We are your media.
You're telling the truth about your world.
The truth you won't get from your local newspaper.
We need your support to survive and grow.
Tune in April 6th and 7th for our two-day radiothon, a live online radio and video broadcast
with 20 hours of special guests.
Liberate your media with your dollars.
Africa is on the rise and the future is black.
Come home to Guyana, the land of many waters.
deserves.
House lots for sale in beautiful Guyana own a piece of paradise.
A modern community, Elaineville is a paradise in the making.
Come home to golden sunshine, Guyana, come home to paradise.
Located in Providence, Guyana, Elaineville is an upscale community with 1/8, 1/4, half, and 1 acre house lots for sale. Elaineville, a gated community with concrete roads, concrete drains, pure water supply, electricity, and recreational park, just to name a few of its infrastructures. With immediate finance available from Hand in Hand and Citizens Bank, you can build your dream home in beautiful Guyana.
Make it Guyana again. Make it your own.
30 minutes from the airport, Elaineville is a paradise in the making. For more info, visit our website, www.elaineville.com.
Guyana, come home to paradise.
In Guyana, domestic violence continues to spread like an epidemic, seeping into the fabric of everyday life, affecting thousands of women and girls, men and boys, gathering momentum and bringing fear, misery, violence, death, and destruction. The most pervasive form of domestic violence continues to be violence against women in the home by male partners. This has its root cause in the historical unequal power relations between men and women. This documentary aims to highlight the complex and dynamic nature of domestic violence by giving survivors the chance to tell their stories. Importantly, we have featured the families of a few women who have died at the hands of their partners. These stories demonstrate that domestic violence does not only affect the family, but it is also a community and national problem with far-reaching impact. Guyana is a signatory to several international rights conventions, such as the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, CEDAW, and the Belém do Pará Convention, which recognizes that violence against women is a violation of their human rights. There have been three main studies conducted on domestic violence in Guyana. The first, by Dans and Schiffbasald in 1989, found that 2 out of 3 women had been beaten at least once by their husband or partner. Red Thread in 2000 found that 1 out of 3 women experienced some type of physical abuse. The third study in 2010, on the incidences and drivers of gender-based violence in Guyana, found that 3 out of 5 women reported lifetime experiences with physical violence by an intimate partner, and nearly 2 out of 5 women had experienced at least 1 act of violence within the past 12 months. Help and Shelter in 2009 found that domestic violence occurred very often, and 2 out of 3 women knew at least 1 person who had suffered this form of abuse. Police figures released in late 2011 indicated that 23 murders between November 1, 2010 and October 31, 2011 were domestic related. Furthermore, between November 25, 2011 and November 25, 2012, a total of 31 women were killed. Domestic violence is behavior, or a pattern of behavior, where, through the use of physical, verbal, sexual, emotional, psychological, and financial abuse, the abuser exerts power and control over the abused person. This results in feelings of intimidation, fear, loss of self-worth, physical injuries, and even loss of life.
He drink and love this house, and then he throw care right away around the house and say, "You can kill me and the children." And I start squealing in the house, because I just imagine he's gonna strike the match anytime, and this is scary. How fast could we get out? And then I have these small children. What, how much of them I would save?
Are you afraid of the person you love? Do you spend a lot of time in fear or in stressed out because you don't know if your life is going to be threatened by this person who you're supposed to love?
Domestic violence can occur between family members and those in a current or estranged marriage, legal or common law. It is a crime and is punishable under Guyana's laws.
The abuse start
by slapping.
But I say it's just a slap, and I didn't take it for nothing. And eventually, from one slap, it turned to a beating.
Kick you, cuff you, and start from there to break jaw, break foot.
He hold me on my shoulder and pull me down, push me onto the chair. And the chair had a nail, and it ripped me straight across here.
When he weary beat with wood, that man take off his shoes and lash me with it. When he done with the shoes, he kicked me like a ball.
When he start to stab me.
I had been a coma. Yeah. That, like for 3 days.
He used to beat her a lot. Beat her a lot. Sometime in the middle of the night, neighbors got to run out to her rescue.
What are the psychological effects of domestic violence on women?
They begin to feel so badly about themselves. There's very low self-concept, low self-worth, and you know, what that does to people is to make them behave in abnormal ways.
It starts troubling me nerves, like forgetting things. Like, trying to get them, like, well, my only daughter at one time, I go for shies over the landing.
He beat me so bad that I don't know what to do. I said, better kill all these children and myself.
I go on the bed and I pull out the pies and I say, if you hit me one more time, I'm going to drink this thing. I open the thing and I pour in it like if there's no tomorrow. I say, well, me and afraid to meet me makeup. And somebody going to tell the other brother who lives down the road, and he run up the road. When he run up the road now, he gets a car for me. And he come with me to the hospital.
I was telling by the gardens, the home stretch, like, he then clocked the night with me that I could walk in, and I didn't know what's going on.
Abusers generally believe they have the right to have control, authority, and domination over their partners. To receive domestic, sexual, and emotional services from their partner and other family members in return for being the provider and protector of the family, and to discipline wrongdoers in the family, especially their partner.
There is this notion that a man is the head of the household, that he is the boss, that everything should be done to either please him or at least to prevent him from getting angry enough. So if a man gets angry and hits, more often than not, the woman is blamed for having done something wrong for which she ought to be punished.
So society is so calm, so nice. If you can't even have a flight. So people won't know that, hey, this is an abuser. And all you be around is friends. And the thing is about it that these same abusers, they talk so nice when they're on a friend about the family. Hey, I don't make joke with my family, shit my family good. And then there's be the ones that it be abusing the spouse.
Abusers tend to be possessive and feel they have ownership over their partners. If they can't have you, no one else can.
The loss of this power, that this is someone who's violating my power and leaving, and therefore it's a challenge to manhood, a challenge to masculinity and perceptions of what masculinity is.
While some physical scars may disappear and heal over time, psychological effects can be overwhelming and long-lasting. The ultimate effect of domestic violence can be death. On the 3rd of January 2011, Sally Mohan was brutally attacked and murdered by her recently estranged husband. 21-year-old Sally had ended the abusive relationship and returned to her family's home. On the night of her murder, Sally's husband crept into the home and repeatedly stabbed her. Her family heard her cries for help, but could do nothing to save her.
She make a holler for me. For nanny. And me just run along the step and me gone at the back there. When me gone at the back there, me see the bike jump out the window at the back door and he gone. All over black he had on. And when me call for she now no hands, and me walk in and go in the room, she had the long shock. And she get the, you see, pure blood.
In December 2011, Jenny discovered the nude and lifeless body of her only daughter, Ayana. Next to Ayana's body, her spouse lay fast asleep. He was arrested and charged for her murder. Their son lost a mother to domestic violence, and his father is now in prison.
And she go home back like in the afternoon, when she don't work, she go right on my house, and then the next day she murdered.
One pack of milk started the argument between Carmelita Jones and her partner. She had brought home the milk for their infant, and he accused her of receiving it from another man.
He's claiming it's a man before, and it wasn't a man. It's my cousin. My mother needs to give her a woman. And because she says somebody gave me the milk, he says it's a man.
Following the argument, he lit Carmelita on fire, and she was rushed to the hospital with severe burns.
She told me that he gave her a lamp to hold, and he threw the kerosene, I don't know. She got burns like her stomach, her two hands, head. Well, the face get a bit scarred because, you know, the fire. All her legs, her back.
A week later, on the 26th of September 2012, she succumbed to her injuries, leaving behind her four young children. Why is it that so many women continue to stay in abusive relationships? This has to do with a process referred to as entrapment. Entrapment usually starts with social isolation.
I was not allowed to go anywhere. If I wanted to come home to my father and see my father, I had to get away.
Even if family do come, like, you can't really talk to nobody for too long.
Me suggest now that this boy used to, you know, stress this girl not to tell me anything. Because we can observe when they come here together, they're always there together.
The first thing they try to do is to make you get a child. And when you get this child now, you don't want to leave because who's going to help you with this child? Sometimes you're not in a, your relative them don't afford to take you in with a child. And no relative keep you. None.
I would ask them, well, what do you think mommy should do? And they all said, mommy should leave.
I really thought, I love the man bad. And, you know, I couldn't imagine life without him.
Women don't feel they're strong enough emotionally to leave someone who is beating them or chasing them or, you know, treating them badly.
We always go and move her out, and he would come back and he would beg her, and she would go back.
Many of the women who have spoken about going back have said that they've had a variety of reasons for going back, and those reasons are complex and very personal to them.
Women also get entrapped through financial dependency.
He made me leave my job and said we can start a life on our own. I used to go out and left nothing for I eat. I used to have to go to the coconut estate, get some money for pick, peel and fetch.
When I come and I tired, I didn't take out the money right away to give him. And he threw all the food on the mat, so we don't have anything to eat again. When I thought he started beat me, shake out my bag, take all the money and he gone and drink.
Religious belief.
I complained to the pastor and he told me fast and pray, don't leave.
It is true that many pastors and church leaders tend to take the position that a family must stay together.
I would not, however, doubt that some religions may allow itself to be interpreted in such a way as to permit levels of violence against women.
Islam teaches that women are equal to men, and this is something people don't understand. They are equal to men. A man has one degree above her because he is responsible for her protection.
We Hindus worship Durga. We say it's perhaps the only religion where, you know, God is seen as woman. So what should it mean to us? What should it mean to us to worship Lakshmi? mother of the universe, Durga, queen of the universe, right? Because the women for us represent this Durga and this Lakshmi in our homes. So I go to temple and I worship Lakshmi, but the Lakshmi that who is in front of me, there is no other Lakshmi than the one who is in front of me. That one I brutalize, but I pretend to go and worship Lakshmi in the temple.
Women also get entrapped through poor health, fear for life, guilt, loss of self, hopelessness, threats against children, emotional blackmail, belief that their partner can change, the cycle of abuse, and being exposed as children to domestic violence in the home.
Remember, there are the good times that always hold us to these abusive partners. We remember when things were nice. We remember when the partner did all the wonderful things and came and called me 20 times a day and how nice it felt.
Children who lose one of their parents to domestic violence are perhaps the most forgotten survivors of domestic abuse and are often confronted with shattered lives and an uncertain future.
Even when she was pregnant, he used to beat her terribly bad.
A lot of people have this misconception that when a child is very small, a baby, you can say and do anything in front of it. But that's not true, because everything is being registered and will have some repercussion later in life.
The baby, 6 months and the three plus, was with her. But the child can't really talk so good. All she say, "Daddy born mommy."
Early this morning, he tell me, "Ma, I can see mother crying." So we say, "We say the mother there," and he came to the picture, and he say, look, she crying." I ask him why he crying for. He said, "That one, his father born."
Some of the effects have to do with a child becoming depressed. You will see children acting strangely. They can become withdrawn. They can internalize that pain that they see happening in their homes, either to the mother or to the father.
Teachers, I'm kind of finding that this child is going to school and she don't be focused on her work. She just saying, she'll be crying when actual daddy beat up my mother.
It's very unfortunate and really sad to think that children at that vulnerable age, you know, have to go through so much, they witness so much violence within their home and with the people that they love most, with their mother or their father.
Children have bad dreams, nightmares that leave them in fear. They also will learn that violence is the way to get what you want done. They may not always show the effect at 5 years of age, but they'll show it at 16 and 17. And these are your children who are prone to become depressed adults, which of course you know can also lead to suicidal thoughts and suicide as well when they get to certain levels of depression.
States have a duty to prevent acts of violence against all their citizens and to investigate, prosecute, and punish perpetrators.
Several reports I made to the police station, and all they tell me, go back is your husband.
I'm not in a position to doubt what they have said. What I know that there are cases where persons contacted me, that they made reports and they had some slow response.
They make me go home back with him. They make me go home back with him, the police. And I get a licking so that I can't remember what is my name.
I believe that was in the earlys, that kind of situation. But more and more as we conduct the training, as we have our regular instruction classes, as we deal with those persons who we find lacking, you find that situation has changed.
She make a lot of reports, a lot, and no police come to our rescue.
I go to station, but he's a police, so they just say settle the matter.
The act is not only for persons who are not in law enforcement, for everyone. And if a police man or woman commits themselves and a report is made, action will be taken. We have developed a policy on domestic violence. We have a zero tolerance policy in that once the report is made, we are mandated to investigate the report, arrest the perpetrator, interview the perpetrator also. Once we have evidence, we prosecute. Where there's no evidence to prosecute, we do referrals for counseling. We have no authority, based on our policy, to settle any matter. If the person returns to the station sometime after and asks for the matter to be settled, the rank supposed to ensure that matter goes before the court, let them take that proposal to the magistrate.
What should abused victims do?
Women in abusive relationships should get out at an early stage from the beginning, because I think if I'd come out at an early stage, it wouldn't have been me to that stabbing.
Mentally, physically, emotionally, destroy you.
One has to counsel that woman. One has to make that woman feel good about herself, that she's able to leave that relationship when it's destroying her.
You don't have to say it. You don't have to go to what I mean to. You don't have to go to emotional, mental, physically stressed. You could come out.
In terms of families, in terms of people who are preparing people for marriage and relationships, it's actually talking about what abuse looks like and actually looking also what a healthy relationship looks like. And so important to have that conversation. I know we always talk about sex education. We never really talk about relationship education.
Tell this man what you want from him. Let he tell you what you want, what he wants from you, if you want to. Anytime he stops you for work, get along with friends, family, your neighbors, you got to think again, because that is the way they isolate you. And you don't have nobody to rescue you when the time comes.
Well, as a survivor of violence, that sometimes when you're in that situation, you just need somebody to talk to. Not to give you directions, but just to talk to.
It's important for victims to tell their stories, whoever the victims are. It's important for people not to stigmatize or blame. It's important for all of us to learn.
We need to talk to the perpetrators as well and get them to understand that this is a human being. This is somebody who they vowed to love and to, you know, to live with and have children with and have a home with, you know, and nobody should or ought to be violated.
What can the community do?
In a community, in a neighborhood where people can do something about it, where people can speak up, because this woman was being beaten for 23 years, people, they said they know, they've heard, but have done nothing. And the church cannot be a church. You can't just go sit and worship. It has no meaning if you are not connected with the cries of people in your own neighborhood.
The community, whoever that community is, should help about educating, because people are believing that they're living up to what the community expects of them. In communities where alcohol is present, communities should really work hard to remove alcohol. Alcohol and other drugs are entering communities, and this is present in a lot of the violence.
When violence plays out in a community, the community, though a microcosm of the society, the community is where it happens. So even before it reaches to the court system, the police, people in the community need to be more aware of the connecting dots. So it's more of what we can do at the early stage of growth, especially for young boys or young males.
In the case of males, the males who are being abused are very shy to come out because of the stigma. They're being mocked at by other males. You know, be a man, do this. You know, even some of them reported. They went to the police and reported, and they were heckled. You know, we have to stop that. It's happening and it's real, and we need to help.
I would wish to encourage, and I believe I will speak on behalf of the force, to encourage the people in community, leaders of communities, to encourage their people to live in love and unity, and to understand that domestic violence, it hurts not only the victim, but the rippling effects.
We can try to let them know that we're here, and there's help in case they need it, and do not stay and bear it by yourself, because in most cases it gets really bad, and there's, as you said earlier, 31 women were killed between November last year and November this year. We want to stop that. Even one is too many.
In 1996, the Domestic Violence Act came into law. This law offers protection to abused persons through the enforcement of protection, occupancy, and tenancy orders.
I must say that the Domestic Violence Act has very far-reaching powers when it comes to protecting women who are victims of domestic violence, and not only women, men too. Anyone in a domestic setting and domestic environment who may be threatened or feel threatened by violence.
These court orders prevent the abuser from being in close proximity to where the abused person lives, works, goes to school, or visits. This documentary has highlighted the dynamics of domestic violence and recommendations and best practices for the reduction and elimination of such violence. We acknowledge that men are also victims of abuse and often face stigma and discrimination when reporting these cases. We recognize that even with an impressive legislative, administrative, and policy framework in place to address domestic violence in Guyana, the incidences of domestic violence continue to plague Guyanese society. In closing, we highlight an excerpt from Guyana's national policy on domestic violence adopted in 2008, which says, "At the root of domestic violence is the real or perceived inequality and subordination of women and children, which extends beyond the individual and family to the wider society. The domestic violence policy also recognizes that there must be a multi-sectoral response which works with community-based interventions and all interest groups. It is the view of Help and Shelter that the full implementation of the National Domestic Violence Policy still remains the most relevant and comprehensive national mechanism for the reduction and elimination of domestic violence in Guyana. Domestic violence is everyone's business. We must all be involved if we are to be successful as a country in removing this scourge. To quote from our national poet, Martin Carter, like the jig shakes the loom, like the web is spun the pattern, all are involved, all are consumed. If you or someone you know is being abused, please call the nearest police station."
This is Max Rameau with Take Back the Land and the Omojo Village. You are listening to UhuruRadio.com, the online voice of the International African Revolution.
One, two, three, four.
Oh, if I could build my whole world around,
I know you
want to
lead me.
Now she'll go her way.
At this time on Sundays, we bring you our artist in the spotlight. And now, our artist in the spotlight.
Play the lonely roller.
been hurting that much more. Life can seem so cruel without that one you love. You're like a dying rose in summer without the one you love. One telephone call, one line or so, could mean a world of difference. Just how much you'll never ever know. But life can seem so lonely without the one you love. One telephone call, mean a world of difference. Just how much you'll never, ever, ever know. But life can seem so long, so lonely. Without the one you love.
I wonder
Yes, I know where you are tonight. You're listening to Golden Sunday Sounds with me, Ron Bob Sample, here on the Uhuru Radio Network. Our artist in the spotlight this week is Aretha Franklin. Aretha Franklin, who will be 70 years old tomorrow, March 25th. Here's an interview that Aretha Franklin recorded just 2 weeks ago.
2 weeks from today, Aretha Franklin will celebrate her 70th birthday. Only a year ago, she was sidelined by a mysterious illness, but the Queen of Soul is on the road again. She is strikingly slimmer.
This is a leaner, meaner Aretha.
Yes. Yeah. Queen of Mean.
Queen of Mean?
All right. You have think
about trying to do to me. Aretha says she's lost 85 pounds, but she hasn't lost her voice. Ooh, my darling. Ooh, darling. How long I have waited for you. How is your health?
My health is wonderful. It is fabulous now.
People were worried about you.
Yeah, I was worried.
What it was, Aretha has never said. But a history of mystery surrounds Lady Soul. She's always been guarded, except when she sings. Baby, baby, sweet baby. At 69, she remains one of the most influential performers in pop history. You make me feel like a natural woman. Rolling Stone magazine named her the greatest singer of the rock era. R-E-S-P-E-C-T, find out what it means to me. R-E-S-P-E-C-T. When we visited her in her hometown of Detroit, Aretha took us to where it all started, the New Bethel Baptist Church.
This is your spot.
This is where I sit when I come to church. This is my seat. Don't sit in my seat.
If you got your house on a solid rock.
Her father, the charismatic Reverend C.L. Franklin, who was pastor here, would electrify audiences with his thunderous sermons.
When you come face to face with temptation,
then he'd call his daughter up to the pulpit.
My dad had to push me to sing, though. I really didn't want to sing.
Aretha was about 10 years old.
I'm standing up on a little box.
You were on a box?
Yeah, the pulpit was too high. So they put a little box next to the pulpit.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I never knew just how he gave
to love me so. So this was your place?
Yeah, this is where we lived.
We went back to the Franklin family home in West Detroit.
You were saying in the day it was a show place.
Yeah, it was definitely a show place. It was the most beautiful home I had ever seen.
Where was your room?
Right here.
The second floor?
Yeah, right there.
Uh-huh.
And when gospel greats like Mahalia Jackson or Clara Ward would visit the house, the young Aretha would watch from the top of the stairs.
To see who was coming in and who was going out and peeping through the railing of the staircase. So it was special, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very special.
Who did you like to see most of all?
Sam Cooke. Anytime, Sam.
Sam is Sam Cooke, then a young gospel singer, 11 years older than Aretha.
Did Sam give you singing advice?
No.
No?
No, Sam, I saw Sam in other terms.
You saw him in other terms?
In other terms.
Which means what, you had a crush on him?
I had a serious crush on him. He had no idea, though, that I had that kind of crush on him. Darling, you.
In 1961, she toured with Cooke, who'd crossed over to become a pop idol.
When I saw the success that he had, I thought that it might be possible for me too.
Somewhere over the rainbow.
Aretha signed with Columbia Records and headed to New York.
This is a young you.
I'm still young. my favorite picture of myself. It's really cute. I just love this picture. My hair is so classic. This was the beginning. When I first went to New York, I took modeling classes.
What were you supposed to learn?
I was walking with a book on my head and all of that sort of thing.
And what were you thinking while you were doing that?
That this is not me. That's what I was thinking. This is not me. I don't like this book, and this is not me.
But I wake up.
In 1967, Lady Soul arrived. In 2 years, she scored 9 top 10 hits. The biggest, Respect, a song written by Otis Redding.
What you want, baby, I got.
And R-E-S-P-E-C-T,
yeah.
Which Otis did not say.
No, he didn't say that. I thought I should spell it out.
In a summer of racial unrest, it became a civil rights anthem. In Detroit, the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. would present Aretha an award in front of 12,000 people.
They declared it Aretha Franklin Day.
Yeah, they did. But when Dr. King walked on the stage, the rafters were shaking.
You better think about what you're trying to do to me.
Aretha wrote her own songs, too, like Think. And Daydreaming, which was inspired by the lead singer of The Temptations, Dennis Edwards.
I was daydreaming about him, yes.
Yeah. I think he said he made a mistake in not marrying you.
Yeah, I said, you sure did. You sure did. Too late now, buddy. Too late.
Loving him a little bit more each day turns me right on when I am sad.
From what I read, he said, he was kind of intimidated by the whole Aretha aura.
Really?
Yeah. Do you think you're intimidating?
I could be.
Yeah.
I could be. I've seen that a little bit with some men.
Mm-hmm.
But the real men step up to the plate.
But then that wall goes up again.
How's your love life these days?
My love life is all right.
That's all you're going to say?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's okay.
Ain't no way. For me to love you.
This January, Aretha announced her engagement to William Wilkerson, but by the end of the month, she'd broken it off. Twice divorced and mother to 4 sons, Aretha also shies away from some of the sorrow in her family's life. Her mother, who moved away when she was 6, died 4 years later. In her autobiography, Aretha wrote, I cannot describe the pain, nor will I try. In 1979, her father was shot during a burglary in their Detroit home. He lingered in a coma for 5 years before his death.
When we were trying to get the park dedicated.
Aretha asked the city to dedicate a local park to him. She wanted us to see it. But as we approached the park, she was overcome by emotion.
Oh, you all right? That still means a lot to you.
It took a minute for her to compose herself.
It's a beautiful park.
It is a beautiful park.
I'm glad they dedicated it to him.
Reverend Franklin envisioned a great career for his talented daughter, but likely even he did not imagine she would live to perform at the inauguration of the first African-American president.
That goes down in history. I'm thankful that I was a part of that.
Aretha made news another way that day.
You got a lot of attention for that hat.
Yes. That hat took on a life of its own.
It sure
Listen,
did.
Listen, okay?
She's donating it to the Obama Presidential Library.
I'll go down in history with him.
Now, after a half century of recording and more than 50 albums, the Queen of Soul is back to remind us that while she may have given up her hat, she has not surrendered her crown.
Suck it to me, suck it to me.
happy day. Oh, happy day. Oh, a happy day. Oh, happy day. When Jesus washed the Lord. Oh, when he washed. Send away. Oh, happy day. Oh, happy day. Oh, happy day.
Oh yeah.
read it. Yeah, wash my sins away. How happy day. How happy day. All in my world, a happy day.
Need to hear some soothing sounds of yesteryear from around the world? Listen to Golden Sunday Sounds with Ron Bob Semple every Sunday from 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
To be with you.
You made me feel.
Be getting a whole lot of respect. Yes, we're celebrating the birthday of Aretha Franklin. She'll be 70 years old tomorrow, March 25th, and she's our artist in the spotlight this evening. Coming up, our back-to-back songs by different artists. I'm Ron Bob Semple with you until 10 p.m. You can give us a call at 1-800-420-5593. That's 1-800-420-5593.
You are listening to Golden Sunday Sounds.
Hi, I'm Felicia Brassad, and I encourage you to support the Uhuru Radio Network because it's independent, it's community, and it's pro-black.
About my man. You see, ain't no need of you girls sweating each other about somebody that don't belong to either one of you. You see, he's still mine. Always have been, always will be, until the end of time. Yeah, I heard you bragging about that little beat up Volkswagen I saw you riding in. Girl, please, I'm pushing a Mercedes Benz. And I heard you talking about that little stuff, you what he likes and you the food he eats. I don't think so, darling. You see, because I give my man a full course meal every night, something to fill him up and satisfy his appetite. And I can see why you and Yolanda ain't got no man. Y'all too busy playing Star 6-9 games. And it really don't make much difference how you're taking this. I just want you to remember one thing. Woman to woman, you ain't woman enough to take my man. Now you check this out. Ooh. You're wasting your time. Be so weak to let
that you're still my man for me. You see, I ain't got no doubt about my position. And girl, let me tell you, you ain't even no competition. You see, there's a difference between
assault on the police. Over the next 17 months, the Uhuru Movement joined by many other organizations, activists, and concerned community members waged a relentless campaign to free Diop. In the process, the community began to recognize Diop as the one who stood up to Nutter and City Hall demanding economic and social justice for the people. Due to his courageous stance against imperialism and commitment to building a revolutionary mass organization of the African working class, Diop was appointed as international president of the International People's Democratic Uhuru Movement in 2010. Diop ran for mayor of Philadelphia in the 2011 elections as the only independent candidate. Diop's campaign called for economic development for the African community and the community control of schools and police. In that process, Diop won 6,400 votes, 4% of the entire voting population, setting a record for the independent candidate with the highest percentage and number of votes in Philadelphia's history. Today, Diop continues to lead the MPDOM internationally, building branches